I'm going to start recording. Before I do, I received lots of your homeworks. There's still some people I think who haven't sent in homeworks, but I have to go back and double check and count. And I haven't yet got you your acknowledgement email saying that I have the homeworks, but I do. So I will send that out this afternoon. I got behind on that. Let me just show you. I also just talked to the audiovisual person about the possibility of projecting graphs like this on the back while I talk on the board at the front. Not possible, because the second projector is in fact dead. However, future classes, I can bring a projector from our lab and put it at the far end, and maybe we can get it to work so I don't have to do this clumsy switching back and forth. Here is, we are talking about dominance and recessiveness in fitnesses, and I was emphasizing that when a recessive allele, whether favorable or unfavorable, is rare, it only runs into another of itself in random mating rather rarely. So mostly it isn't often getting, it's only selected, only a small number of the copies in the population are getting favored or disfavored, or in individuals who are favored or disfavored by selection. So change is slow when the allele is rare, just because it's only selected when it runs into another of itself. When it gets to be common, you have the opposite situation where it's a rare dominant, and a rare dominant does get selected because it is showing up in heterozygotes, and those are different in fitness. And I guess what I should also emphasize, and I didn't do it earlier, is that, maybe over here, there's a very simple phenomenon that's a consequence of Hardy-Weinberg, and that is that rare genes occur mostly in heterozygotes. And the way to see that is, and we already use that principle, because I already used the fact that if you're a rare allele, and you're in an individual, what is the other allele most likely in that individual? Well, the answer is, if you're rare, it's much less likely that it's another one of you. So rare alleles occur mostly in heterozygotes. Not, of course, always, because otherwise there would be no selection against recesses, or for or against recessive alleles. But if you would say, if we say, what's the probability of that the other allele is big A, and you're looking at an allele and asking what's the probability the other allele is big A. It doesn't matter what you are, it's just the gene frequency of that allele. So it's P sub big A. So if you were looking at a copy of an allele that has a frequency of 1 in 1,000, the chances are 999 times out of 1,000 the other allele is the allele you find in that the other copy you find in that diploid individual is the more common allele. So it's just its gene frequency. And the effect of this is, as I said, that rare recessive alleles are selected, our selection acts on them more weakly than when they're rare dominant alleles. Okay. So here we see selection curves for a case where the fitnesses of the three genotypes are little a is fitness one, and then if big A is dominant, there's a fitness of 2.3. So this is like a 130% increase in fitness in the heterozygote, and 2.3 continues as also the fitness in the homozygote. So these are 2.3 and that is 1. That's the case with circles, and here they go. If you start them at 1%, that's a rare dominant allele, in this case favored, and you see it goes up in frequency quite nicely and gets up in here. But the curve is not, it is sigmoidal. If I start low enough here, I'll see a gradual curve upwards. It's not very visible here. And it's sigmoidal, but it's very asymmetric. So unlike the case of multiplicative fitnesses, where the rise in frequencies up to 50% is just a mirror image of the continued rise up to 100%, here goes up quickly and then much, much more slowly. As it gets up into this 90% realm, most of the copies of the favored allele, which in this case is big A, are found in big A's, and most of the copies of the rare allele, which is now little a, are found in this one. Those two have the same fitness. So the fitnesses of the individuals in which this allele finds itself are nearly equal, except that occasionally a little a runs into another little a, and then its fitness is lower, namely 1. So that's the reason for this very gradual increase, and it does go all the way to 1 in theory, but takes a very long time to do it. Here's the mirror image case. In fact, this is very nearly a flipped version of that. You start out at 1%. This is the case where only the big A homozygote has a higher fitness, the others are 1. When it's rare, there is rather little selection, but it is favoring it because occasionally these rare big A's do occur. Finally, it gets up to this frequency, and then it goes zooming up and goes into 1 rather quickly. So same phenomenon I've been obsessing about here. So that is, I wanted to show you that and emphasize this idea that rare alleles are mostly out there in heterozygotes and not in homozygotes. Okay, now I want to go back to the board and talk about overdominance and underdominance, and that's going to take our usual problem of, let me disconnect, and I think if you punch that and to turn it off, that's it, just leave it, and it will take a while, but it'll turn itself off. And we can go back to the front board. So, let's see. I was doing all sorts of dominant and multiplicative, dominant and recessive cases before. Now I'm going to do overdominance and then underdominance. And those are cases that are of not tremendously widespread occurrence, but they tell you something important about what natural selection does to fitnesses and what natural selection doesn't do. And in particular, they tell you that the booming-voiced announcers in nature documentaries on television are completely full of it. They are always saying, nature is so set up that everything is optimal. You know, they're always giving you this line of, everything is beautifully balanced in nature. You know, well, I'm going to show you that it's not. Organisms are not at all optimal. And let's start by a case where we have our usual genotypes, and now the heterozygote has the highest fitness. So I'm going to use this notation. These are relative fitnesses, of course. And I'm going to... Let me just double check that I have the S and the T in the same places in the book. Excuse me for a moment. Okay, now. Yeah, we're fine. Okay, so And once again, we're going to use P for the gene frequency, P sub big A. We're just going to call it P. And we have at the start of the generation, right after random mating, the usual Hardy-Weinberg proportions. And the equation for the change of gene frequency will be, as usual, the new gene frequency equals the old gene frequency times the ratio between the mean fitness of big A's and the mean fitness of everybody. Okay. And that will be, now the mean fitness of big A's, you may recall, is a weighted average of P times the fitness of big A, plus 1 minus P times the heterozygote fitness. And W bar is in the denominator. And we saw that before. And in this case, when you plug in what the 1 minus S's, you'll get P times 1 minus S plus 1 minus P times 1. And then in the denominator, you're going to get P squared times 1 minus S plus the heterozygote frequency times 1 plus the homozygote frequency of little a times 1 minus t. Okay. The latter, we will be looking at that in a moment. But for the moment, we're sort of concentrating on the numerator. And this will be, what I want to do is get from this the change of gene frequency. So it's delta P. It's the new frequency minus the old. You just plug in what you have down here. And that will be P times P 1 minus S plus 1 minus P minus, let's see, over W. I'm going to put a W bar over everything here. And I'm going to put the W bar, P times W bar, out here. All I did was subtract the P from both sides and then move the numerator in the sort of usual way. This looks not too interesting, but we can take a P out front of the whole thing. This is, if you collect these terms here, you'll get a P plus a 1 minus P minus SP. So it turns out to be 1 minus SP, this thing here. The W bar turns out to be 1 minus S times P squared minus T times 1 minus P quantity squared. I'm divide by, and I'll leave the denominator just W bar. So I did one step in my head. Let me just confirm that. This here can also be written. If you look, you'll see the thing you're multiplying by here sometimes has a 1 in it and has terms with an S in it, a 1 in it, an S. If we collect all the 1's terms, we get P squared plus 2P1 minus P plus 1 minus P squared quantity squared. That times 1. And then there's a minus SP squared and a minus T times 1 minus P quantity squared. So this is just 1. So it's 1 minus SP squared minus T times 1 minus P squared. So straightforward algebra. If you look at that up there and do a little collecting, we get somewhere. We get that the 1 and a minus 1 cancel. There's a minus SP and a plus SP squared, because it's minus minus SP squared, plus T, 1 minus P quantity squared. And you look at it and say, well, it's not very illuminating. But if you look closely, you'll see that P and there's a P and then an opposite sign, P squared. So this is actually minus S times P times 1 minus P, these two. And this one already has a 1 minus P squared quantity squared. And W bar is in the denominator. And now we can say, well, there's a 1 minus p in every term here. P times 1 minus p times, and now we get something nice, minus sp plus t times 1 minus p. And then denominator same as usual.
Okay, so we did a little bit of algebra there. So what it says is the change of gene frequency has got a p and a 1 minus p, which means if you're where everybody's a big A or everybody's a little a, then there's no change by natural selection. That's not very surprising. And then there's this thing in brackets. And the thing in brackets is linear in p, and it's, you can look at it and say, well, in the overdominance case, S and T will be positive. What will happen if P is small, and what will happen if P is large? And first I'll give you the algebra, and then I'll give you a more intuitive rationale. The when P is nearly zero, this will be minus S times something small plus T minus T times something small. So it'll be mostly close to T. So it'll be approximately T if P, this term, if P near zero. And what will it be if P is nearly one? Can somebody look at that and tell me what the thing in brackets will be close to if P is nearly one?
Negative S.
Sorry?
Negative S.
It will be, yes, negative S, because when P is nearly 1, this 1 minus P term is nearly 0. This thing here is minus S times something that's nearly 1. So minus S if P is near 1. So the quantity favoring, the quantity indicating whether big A is being favored is sometimes positive and sometimes negative. And you can draw a graph. And I'll actually project you this graph in a moment. But you can draw a graph where you plot not time on the bottom, but the gene frequency. And vertically, you plot the change of gene frequency. And then you say, well, if P is near zero, it's a value T, whatever T is. If P is near one, it's a value, let me put a dotted line across here that's zero, minus S. Now you might say, well, what are T and S? And the answer is they're just some positive numbers, and then they could have different values. And what is this expression? Well, it's a linear, it's a simple linear formula. So it's simply going down like that. And that means there's a point where it reaches zero. The point where it reaches zero is where this thing in brackets is zero, and that's an equilibrium gene frequency, and in fact, a couple of steps of very, very, very ninth grade algebra will get you that it is T over S plus T. It's, people have an attraction to the value 1/2. Say, oh, it's a half. No, it isn't, because T doesn't have to be equal to S. It's something in between. T and between zero, sorry, it's a value between zero and one depending on the sizes of T and S. So that says, in turn, when you are down below this equilibrium value, which is T over S plus T, that's here, when you're below it, the fitness, the selection is moving the gene frequency up. When you're above it, it's moving it down. And you might say, well, then obviously it's going to converge on that equilibrium. Almost. But there's the theoretical possibility that a system that does, that's like this, where the changes point towards the equilibrium from below and also from above, that it could actually overshoot the equilibrium and end up further away than it started. Further algebra can show that that doesn't ever happen in this case, that the change doesn't ever overshoot.
you do in fact smoothly approach the equilibrium from below and from above. And so, so there you have it. Now, before we get to, I'll show you a projection showing you some of this, that's again figures from the book. But before we get to it, I want to give you a rationale. Why is selection favoring big A when rare? Well, let's look, let's use the principle that rare alleles occur mostly in heterozygotes. Let's ask about the average fitness of big A containing individuals, places that big A's find themselves, and the average fitness of places that little A's find themselves. So let's look up here. If you're a big A, you're mostly in heterozygotes. And if you're rare, you're mostly in heterozygotes. So when big A is rare, but B is small, the average fitness of places that big A's find themselves is nearly one. It's a little below that because it could occasionally run into another one of itself. Okay. Where do the common alleles find themselves? Well, by the same principle, the common alleles find themselves mostly in homozygote with themselves. And so, in a case where big A is rare, the average fitness of big A's is near 1, and the average fitness of little A's is near 1 minus T. So big A's are favored because they're the ones that are occurring in the heterozygotes. And that's what's happening right here. You see that the this term, which represents a sort of a net selection coefficient on big A's, is nearly T. Okay. Same argument used at the other end of the scale. When little a is rare, where are the little a's? Well, the little a's, when big A is common, so you're at the right end of that scale, little a is rare, the little a's are mostly in the heterozygous and have fitness 1. The big A's are mostly in homozygote with themselves, because that's who they run into in random mating, and their fitness is 1 minus S. So big A's now have a disadvantage when little a is rare, when big A is common. So if big A is common, then you have the net selection coefficient being minus S. So you can intuit the whole thing. If you just use the fact that rare alleles occur mostly in heterozygotes, and very, you know, common alleles, common alleles occur mostly in homozygotes. Okay. So simply as a consequence of random mating. Now let's take a look at a couple of things, and one of them is, by the way, I also want to look at the average fitness. The average fitness of the population, I want to say, as this goes on, what's happening to the average fitness of the population? Well, the average fitness is this W bar thing, and that was 1 minus SP squared minus T times 1 minus P squared. If you look at that, you'll say, well, that's a quadratic formula. It's got terms in P and terms in P squared and constant terms, yes?
Before we move on, could we talk about the result we just came up with?
The result that?
That when
the... I just missed a word and my hearing has problems.
When the alleles are rare, selection can act more effectively.
Well, selection acts based on what they are in heterozygote.
Right.
Which yes. may be more effective or it may be less effective depending on who's dominant and who's recessive.
Right. And does that have something to do with the population as a whole versus?
This is all the population as a whole. I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, if you try to think biologically what's going on, it's kind of a confusing result. It makes sense mathematically, like you just showed, but...
Well, it again comes out from the fact that the rare alleles are in the heterozygotes are better fitness than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Whichever allele is rare will mostly be showing up in its copies will mostly be in heterozygotes. Whichever allele is common, its copies will mostly be in homozygotes, which are worse off.
So it's acting through the heterozygote selection.
It's because the fit, high fitness of the heterozygote in this case. Okay. Now, if you look at this W bar formula, it's a quadratic, and we're going to see it in a moment on the projection. I hope I have this. But first, we have to struggle with the projector. So if you could push the left button, please, left top button, and then the projector will gradually wake up. Oh, I have to put the screen down. Okay, projectors, what is coming on? Okay, so the overdominant case has this pattern. Okay, there it is. Now we just get the lights down. Return them fairly far off. Okay, now with luck. Come on. Yeah, here is the change of gene frequency. Yeah, there it goes. This is a figure from the book. Now we have a case where there's overdominance. The fitness of the heterozygote is 1. S is 0.15, so the fitness of 1 minus S is 0.85. T is 0.3, so it's 70%. So there's the fitnesses. Here is a plot of the change of gene frequency, which is that formula. I'm sorry, I keep hitting the mouse here. There. Okay, sorry. Here's the plot of the formula I showed you, the whole thing with P times 1 minus P times a thing in brackets over W bar. And what you'll see is, of course, it's 0 at the end of the scale. The change in gene frequency won't happen if there's only one allele in the population. But it's positive in this region, highest here. Falls to 0 here. That's the point where that square brackets term is 0, where you're right at the equilibrium. The equilibrium is, in fact, at 2/3 in this case. If you calculate T over S plus T, it's 2/3. Above it, the change is negative. So if you're on a gene frequency scale, which is the horizontal scale here, you'll march rightwards towards the equilibrium, or if you're over here, you'll march leftwards toward the equilibrium. Now, with a little luck, here is that process for the same case, starting from 99% here and from 1%. And what you see is a nice kind of logistic-looking curve coming up to the equilibrium and a nice logistic curve coming down to the equilibrium, and they converge on it from both sides. So we have natural selection here actively pushing you towards a polymorphism, an equilibrium in which there are multiple forms in the population. All the other forms of selection I showed you, pure dominance, pure recessiveness, multiplicative, there one allele was displacing the other and taking over. Here, selection is maintaining variability in the population. Now, I want to confess to you that there aren't very many cases that we know of where there's overdominance. One of the classic ones was always sickle cell anemia, where in Africa, in the presence of falciparum malaria, the sickle cell allele, if you have one copy of it, you don't have the sickle cell disease, you have so-called sickle cell trait, but not the sickle cell disease, because that occurs in the homozygote when the hemoglobin in the blood crystallizes and the blood cells are distorted, they get caught in capillaries and bad things happen to them and happen to you. But in the heterozygote, in fact, one is more resistant to malaria, and one is more resistant to malaria because a blood cell that is infected by the malaria parasite will have sickling, will have this crystallization, and it will tend to get trapped and removed from circulation. So actually, individuals who are heterozygous for the sickle cell allele have a higher fitness in the presence of falciparum malaria. Okay, that's a classic case. It was worked out in the 1950s. And everyone was very excited and said, well, once they understood that there was a lot of enzyme variation in populations, they said, maybe it's overdominant. And there was a whole giant struggle between two groups of people, the people who said balancing selection will be responsible. This is a form of balancing selection. Selection of this sort pushing towards an equilibrium because of overdominance or because of a different scheme, frequency-dependent selection. They said this is going to be widespread. It explains why there's so much variability. And it's the explanation for the high levels of polymorphism in human and other populations. The other side of the argument were people who said, no, this will be very rare. The explanation for the variation will be that it's introduced by mutation and natural selection is in the process of pushing out the deleterious alleles. To get ahead of the story, it turned out that neither was actually correct, that a lot of the variation is selectively neutral, which we will get to and talk about later in the course. But it was thought to be a very important pattern. I have to say that although, of course, we don't know the natural selection in many loci in detail, and it could be weak and still effective, and they're weak enough to have trouble detecting, I think that overdominance is, in fact, a pretty rare pattern for natural selection. And then you might say, well, so why are you talking about it? Why spend so much time on it? And one of the answers is because of the way it connects to the average fitness of the population. I'm going to come back to underdominance in a second. But here is a case where fitnesses are 0.55 in the one homozygote, 0.25 in the other homozygote, and 1 in the heterozygote. So it's an overdominant case. And what I'm now plotting here is that quadratic that I just showed you, the average fitness of the population, 1 minus s times p squared minus t times 1 minus p squared. And what you find is it goes up. It's a quadratic. It's a parabola. The parabola is pointing upwards. It has the peak. It has a peak here. And amazingly enough, the peak is exactly where... No, it's not two-thirds, because this case has different selection coefficients and the equilibrium is not two-thirds. Here, the peak is, I think it's around point, it's in the text, but I think it's around 0.625. Let me just see. I'll calculate it. If we have 1 minus s, 1 minus t, and these are 0.55, 1, 0.45, and S is 0.45, and T is that was 0.25 over here, 0.75. And so T over S plus T will be equal to 0.75 over 0.45 plus 0.75. And if you look, you can say, well, they all got 0.05s in them. So we can take that out, 0.15 over, I'm dividing by 5, top and bottom, 0.09 plus this was a 0.75, 0.15. 15 over 24, 5 over 8, 5/8. So 0.625, exactly what I thought I remembered. So 0.625 is equilibrium, not 0.666. So it happens that the peak of the parabola is exactly where the equilibrium is. And that's not a coincidence in this numerical case. It's true in general. Because what you can show is that the formula for the change of gene frequency can be rewritten. Remember that it had a p. Well, hold on a second. P times 1 minus p times something. And what is that something? It also is the derivative
of W bar with respect to P. Here's a derivative now, a little bit of calculus. It's the slope of W bar against P. So when you look at this curve, on all the parts where the slope is positive, the gene frequency will be changing rightwards, and all the parts where the slope is negative, the gene frequency will be changing leftwards, and it'll be coming to the peak of mean fitness as a function of gene frequencies. And that's generally true. It's true for this overdominant case. It's also true for all the other cases. The other cases aren't so interesting because the slope is the same throughout the interval and you're just headed for fixing one allele or other. And we'll see in the underdominant case, the parabola goes the other way. And then you have even more interesting consequences. You had a question before I go on.
I just think that this was what my original question was about.
I've forgotten what. You mean the one I didn't understand?
Well, I was basically wondering how it connected to the population.
Well, here it's how it connects to the mean fitness of the population.
Yeah,
I mean, of course, all this is happening in the population. So
right.
Without the population, none of this happens. But mean fitness, it connects to mean fitness. So then we can say, aha, selection is optimizing mean fitness. And that's an important fact. And that seems to give credence to what those booming-voiced announcers on nature documentaries are always saying to you. This beautifully adapted species, you know, they go on and on like that. And we've all heard, when I was a kid, there were only two nature documentaries on television. In the 1950s, when I was a teenager, there was there was some Walt Disney ones in which the evil hawk never quite caught the virtuous mouse. Okay, and then there was Marlon Perkins, the director of the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, had one called At the Zoo, where they would literally bring a camera into the zoo. It was a small zoo in Chicago, not the main Brookfield Zoo, a small one that I think has been long closed. Someone from Chicago can tell me. And he would put the camera pointing at a cage, and there'd be an animal, and then he'd tell you about the animal. And he later had a show called Wild Kingdom. Those are the only nature documentaries on television. Now, you cannot, you know, everywhere you look, there are all kinds of nature documentaries, but they all have the same thing. They all have a tremendously authoritative announcer who tells you how perfectly adapted everything is. Okay, I'm going to give you the other side of the argument now. This seems to verify it. Okay, but now let's go back to underdominance. I'll do it over here because I don't want to shut down the projector. Underdominance has the same exact mathematics. Let me erase this rare alleles principle, although we're going to use it in a second. Underdominance has everything the same except S and T are negative. So the first thing I can say to you is I don't have to do any of the algebra. We all just did it. But we all pretended when we looked at it and interpreted that S and T were positive quantities. Now S and T are going to be negative quantities. The heterozygote will have the worst fitness. And the gene frequency formula will, of course, be the same one we got. T times 1 minus P minus S times P. Somebody tell me if that all over W bar. There, once again, the effective selection coefficient, the thing in brackets, is linear in P, and it has the function that if you make a plot of that thing in brackets, at when P is nearly zero, let's put zero, the level zero on here, and this is going to be T times 1 minus P minus SP. That's the thing that we're plotting here.
it's going to be t at the left side and minus s at the other side. Okay, but now t is negative and so is s. So it'll be t down below 0 and s minus s, which is above 0 because s is negative, so minus s is positive. And there will once again be a straight line between them. I'm drawing it very badly. There will once again be a point where it crosses 0, not necessarily 1/2. Everyone always says, oh, it's got to be a half, got to be. No, it doesn't. And now look at it and think about what the gene frequencies are going to do. If you're to the left of this, this is an equilibrium point. It is a point where if the gene frequency gets exactly there, it stays there. This thing in brackets is 0, so there's no change of gene frequency. But if you're to the left of it, it's negative. And that means the gene frequency is going down towards 0. If you're to the right of it, it's positive. You don't even have to ask questions about overshooting because it's not even headed for the equilibrium. Of course, it can't overshoot 0 or 1. It's not possible. Gene frequency will trend away from the equilibrium if it's below it or above it.
It's like a source.
Well, I wouldn't use the word source, but I would say that the equilibrium is where these are perfectly balanced. If you get to exactly that gene frequency in an infinite population with no departures from the model, you'll stay exactly there. But even a tiny departure from it, and you'll slowly start creeping away. So when you look at, yeah, I didn't put the plot for underdominance here. That is stupid of me. Yeah, what you have to imagine is this curve flipped upside down. It's a parabola with its minimum at the equilibrium. And yes, the equilibrium is the point where it's at a minimum because of this formula with derivatives here.
Does that mean the population has fitness with two peaks?
Yes. And here you see that behavior. So here we see underdominance. So what is it going to be? It's going to be 1.15 is the fitness. So S is minus 0.15. And T is minus 0.3. These were 1 minus S and 1 minus T. And the heterozygote is 1. And you'll see that if you start near the equilibrium but a bit above it, the equilibrium here is, this one happens to be at 2/3. You don't change very much, but you start creeping away from it, and then you get cringe faster and faster, and then you slow down as you get to the axis. If you start just below it, not far away from that, it goes the other direction and goes slowly at first and faster and then slowly again. So you're moving away from the equilibrium in either direction. Yeah?
So would a case of underdominance be like having two, like a protein subunit that would only match with another? Like, I'm trying to think of what a situation of...
Yeah, a dimer, a protein that's a dimer.
Okay.
Where the most functional dimer, most functional protein will be the two different alleles. But where it's less functional if it's two of the same allele or two of the other allele.
Okay.
Now, what I'm going to explain in a bit, probably next time, is that such cases are rare, but there's an important case involving chromosome rearrangement that acts exactly like this. Before we get there, let me just give you the rationale of this in terms of rare alleles, common alleles. Let's just think about this rare allele principle in random mating. If you are the big A allele and you're rare, what happens? Well, the big A finds itself mostly in heterozygotes. The little a, the common allele, finds itself mostly in little a homozygotes. But here, T and S are negative. So the one in the heterozygotes is worse off than the one in the homozygotes. So the rare allele is worse off in this case. The exact opposite of what you had in the overdominant case. So the rare allele is worse off, and it will keep declining in frequency. Whichever, if it gets down far enough, it'll keep going. Similarly, go on to the other side. The common allele, when common, occurs mostly in homozygotes. That's good. The rarer allele occurs mostly in heterozygotes. That's bad. So again, whichever allele is more common, if it's common enough, it continues to get more common. Natural selection favors it. Now, we're at the end of the hour, but where I will pick up next time is tell you why that says that the booming-voiced announcers, the tremendously authoritative announcers, who when you look at the credits, always turn out to be well-known actors, and they don't know anything about biology, but whoever wrote their text is wrong, because I'm going to show you that you won't always climb the highest fitness peak. You'll climb the nearest fitness peak on a fitness surface. And thus, all is not, just a second, big punchline, all is not for the best in this best of all possible worlds. And we will prove that next time. But you had a last minute question.
No, I'm just happy with what you said.
Okay, good. You darn well better be. Okay. We will pick this up next time, and I will Wednesday get the homeworks back to you. If you didn't turn in a homework, turn it in, because it's much better to get partial credit than zero.
Are we going to talk about the chromosome rearrangement?